And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Stay tuned. It is now time for Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and my guest this evening, the featured performer, is Billy Cobham. And if you don't know who he is, you should stay tuned and check him out. So this was for both BB and Jack Johnson?
Well,
I started a little premature. Don't check about that soon.
Oh, gosh.
My theme is missing, so I can't play that right now. Uh-oh, Sydney's here, and I think he has an announcement. Stay tuned.
I don't have the details just yet. I'll bring those in, Joyce, if you allow me. Apparently, the president's about to make an announcement that Osama bin Laden has been killed. I don't have any details, and I'll be back with you in a few minutes.
Okay, then. Well, thank you, Sydney. And Sydney Smith will be returning shortly with an announcement, if it is available, if the details are available. And like I said, this is Sugar in My Bowl. Stay tuned for Billy Cobham. My name's Joyce Jones. You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. And on the line, or actually via Skype, we have...
Billy Cobham.
Well, thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
It's a pleasure. It's mine, Joyce.
I guess I should start with... we'll start from the beginning. You were born in Panama?
Yes, I was. In Colón.
Have you been back there?
Yes, I've been back there a few times.
How have you experienced it as an adult?
It was a reawakening. When I came to the United States, I was 3 years old, plus a few months, and remember very little about the country. I returned back to Panama in 2005, I think, and that was the first time since 1947. And so things were quite different, and I was quite impressed. You know, you want to go back again and take a look. And over time, it's now really a special place for me and my family to go.
Do you still have relatives there?
Almost too many. It's just a lot. We are a tribe. It's huge. But nonetheless, lovable. The mindset and is a whole other world. It's just quite different. There are a few rules you have to, get to know. That will help you a lot when you're down there. One is just to learn Spanish, and I still have not done that properly. But it makes a very big difference to be able to speak Spanish to the people there and collaborate or communicate in that way. It's great.
So when did you start playing drum? Did you play hand percussion first and then go to a kit, or how did that work?
I played on anything I could when I was a little person. With anything I could get in my hands, because it just felt very natural, and I enjoyed beating on things, like pots and pans and plates and saucers, and using spoons and knives and forks. And then my parents got me a little drum set from Woolworths that lasted about 6 hours into Christmas Day, and that was the end of that. But at least everybody understood that was my general direction. I wanted to play in music. My father and mother were musicians, so it was kind of normal.
Okay. I had to interrupt Billy Cobham because the president's going to be giving a speech soon. And Sydney, our operations person, is on standby waiting for Barack Obama, our president, to deliver news about Osama bin Laden. Stay tuned.
anything I could get in my hands because it just felt very natural, and I enjoyed beating on things, like pots and pans and plates and saucers and using spoons and knives and forks. And then my parents got me a little drum set from Woolworths that lasted about 6 hours into Christmas Day. And that was the end of that. But at least everybody understood that that was my general direction. I wanted to play in music. My father and mother were musicians, so it was kind of normal.
What did your parents, did they play?
My mom sang a lot, and actually she wasn't professional, but my father was a professional pianist, and he actually provided me a platform to work when I first started with him by taking me out to venues where he would work in Long Island from time to time when I was very young, 8 or 9 years old. First came, we were in Brooklyn in the Bed-Stuy area between Lewis and Stuyvesant on Chauncey Street. We lived there for about 10 years, right across from Robert Fulton Park. So that was the region where we lived, and at the time it was a very rich region, a cross-section of in terms of societies of Caribbean blacks and Puerto Ricans and all. It was really a very special area. And there was a bar that was called Dodgers, and it was owned by some of the guys from the Brooklyn Dodgers at that time. Yeah, so it was a pretty special place.
Were you into sports?
Yes, I was.
What'd you play?
Baseball. I was a Dodger fan.
What position?
I was a catcher.
You said you had gigs with your father?
Not very many, but I did, yes.
When did you start playing more consistently? How old were you, and where were you playing?
I think I started to play consistently by the age of about 17 or 18 years old. I went to the School of Performing Arts, which was called the High School of Music and Arts, and it was located on 137th Street and Convent Avenue in Harlem on the City College campus. And so I had the chance to rub elbows with the likes of Eddie Gomez, great bassist who used to be in my homeroom class, and Fred Lipschitz, and let's see, I met Bobby Colombi, the drummer with a band called Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Then there was Larry Willis, who was 2 years ahead of me in school, a great jazz pianist, and Jimmy Owens, I think he was at least 1 year ahead of me in school.
Did you play with them?
Sure.
Oh,
okay. We worked together. Those are the people whom I met. I played with them very much in high school because they were ahead of me. They were seniors or juniors when I was a freshman or sophomore. We played dances. Oh, I'll tell you what. That was really interesting. At that time, I met a guy who played piano. But he went to Performing Arts High School downtown on, I think it was on 46th Street. His name is George Cables. Well, George and I go back to the day when we had a band together with colleagues about our age. And we had a band called the Jazz Samaritans. And he was a piano player in the band. And that was 1962, 63, 64.
Wow. You lasted for a while, didn't you?
Well, we didn't have anything else better to do. So we really did have an opportunity to play until I went into the military. And I got into the United States Army Band around 1964. And at that point in time, another drummer came into the band named Lenny White.
Ah, yes.
And he took my place. And a keyboard player by the name of Weldon Irvine started to work in the band as well.
Weldon Irvine later was a musical director for Nina Simone.
There you are.
Yeah. He unfortunately transitioned, but he was a really great guy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. He came chock full of all kinds of ideas for many things that I didn't have a chance to participate in, really. But he was a real wealth of information, and he was a very organized person.
So you were in the military band, what, until... 68?
Until 1968, and I joined Horace Silver's band at the recommendation of Jimmy Owens.
Yes. Tell me about your experience with playing with Horace Silver. How was that for you?
impressive. In those days, he could count some tempos off. Well, I'll tell you. He had such a tremendous sense of intensity. I could never understand how strong someone could be. He was, at the end of the day, the show, he would have lost maybe 5 pounds weight just in water. And he was already thin when we got on the bandstand.
Actually, I saw a video clip of a performance. I can't remember exactly where it was, but you're in a suit, which was a surprising visualization for me to begin with. But you were, everybody was pretty much, you know, dripping sweat.
Yes. I think that the one that may be on YouTube is the one from the Copenhagen Jazz Festival.
Yes.
And it has Bill Hardman playing trumpet in place of Randy Brecker. That's the one I know. John B. Williams.
John B. Williams on bass.
Yeah. And Betty Maupin played tenor saxophone.
Thank you.
That was the one thing that, that Horace really did for us that was very, very special. He got us all suits that looked the same. And it was great. But we had to wear that suit.
Yeah. You know,
every gig was the same brown suit.
Oh, my goodness.
But it worked. It worked very well.
Yeah. You looked like you were having fun, though. Definitely.
Oh, we had a blast. It was never a dull moment, and I learned a lot. I can still tap into that, those experiences, and always somehow relate to something now that I go, yeah, right. I've seen that, been there, done that. I understand. Earlier in my career, I might not have tapped into it. I find that as I become more experienced in this particular area of the business, I find I'm desperate to tap into any past experiences that I've had to see how they compare so that I can identify with them.
Oh,
Tell me about Dreams, the band.
We were, I think it was about three horns, and so it was about eight people in the band, if I'm mistaken. We had guitar, drums, bass, and keyboard. So, that, yeah, eight, and the lead singer, three horn player. We had incredible talent and a lack of understanding as to how to harness it. So, again, it was a learning. We were individuals. We were not really a band. We were under a band name. But we didn't work really as well as a band. But what came out of that experience for me was the exposure of geniuses like Michael Brecker, Randy Brecker, Don Gralnick. These were pretty special people.
Yeah, I noticed, let's see, John Abercrombie, Barry Rogers.
Yes.
And Will Lee. Spike Lee's father?
Yeah, well, when Will came into the band, if you take a look at the second recording that we made, we only made two that I was involved in.
Okay.
You'll see the picture on the album cover sleeve of everybody going into a cave. Well, the very first person walking into the cave whom you can't see, you can only see the backside of, is me, because I was leaving the band to go to Mahavishnu.
Ah.
And Will Lee had just joined the band and just made that record. So I had not had a lot of time to play with Will, maybe once or twice, and then I was gone.
Love to let another in, then she'll come.
So let's fast forward from 1971 or so, 70, to the present, to 2010. I then played with Lee for the very first time for 1 week in Japan last December.
Oh.
In between that, I'd never worked with
him. Yeah, there seems to be a lot of that. From what I understand, you had a similar experience with Ayoto, that you would, you've known each other for a long time, and you never actually got a chance to work together until, why don't you tell me?
I think it was around 2004, and we've always been rubbing elbows, you know, we talked, he came to my house when I lived on 72nd Street, he brought a big, huge pot of food, but we just never really did anything. I did produce a recording of him for Creed Taylor back in the early 70s on Salvation, he and Flora.
Okay, I'm going to take this moment to interrupt. Ayerto, what you're listening to right now is Ayerto Morero from Virgin Land. It was released on, what did he say the name of that company was? Oh, God, I'm going to blank. I'm drawing a blank. You mentioned the record label. Anyway, I'll have to get back to you on that. But this one is from a King Records reissue. The name of the song is Hot Sand, written by Ayerto Morera, released in 1974. This release was produced by Billy Cobham. Before that, we heard from the band Dreams. We heard Here She Comes, Here She Comes, Here She Comes. Here She Comes, actually. Just only one. And that was Will Lee sharing... sharing lead vocals with Edward Vernon on Here She Comes. That was from Imagine My Surprise, the second release from Dreams. And before that we heard... What did we hear? Try Me! Which was arranged by Michael and Randy Brecker and Barry Rogers, the trombonist, who later went on to play with Billy Cobham in, with the Fania All-Stars. Let's see, before that we heard... What did we hear? We heard a YouTube video, actually. It was from... it was Horace Silver, and you can see it yourself. Just look for Billy Cobham drum solo and Horace Silver. It'll come up. It's a delightful-looking video. There's actually a longer version, but that was just a snippet of that video. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl, and eventually an announcement from the President of the United States, Barack Obama, to announce that Osama bin Laden has transitioned, apparently. Anyway, stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl.
I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
Okay, that was President Barack Obama announcing the demise of Osama bin Laden. Stay tuned.
But I didn't play on it. I was just a producer. So I think he and I worked together in 2004 at the Iridium. And that was the first time that I worked with IRTO where we had an actual chance to play together. Oh, no. It was even earlier. IRTO and I worked in Moscow. I invited him to be my guest, I think, in 2003.
But you recorded together, didn't you, at some point?
Yes, we have. We record with Miles.
Ah, yes. Yes, on the Jack Johnson recording.
I think so.
You had a story about IRTO and the instruments that he played, the amount of instruments that he played, and how he would pick up a pipe or something, and it would become an instrument no matter what he picked up.
He's very, to this day, very gifted at making music on anything. He's one of the most incredible tambura players I've ever seen. The Brazilian equivalent of a tambourine in the north, and he can make that thing. You just don't need a band. You don't need a drum. Just him singing and playing that, and you've got a band. Mm-hmm. No problem.
Con ustedes, por primera vez en Puerto Rico, Manu Dubango, Paul Macota.
That means in Africa. Buenas noches, todo el mundo. Yo soy muy alegre de estar aquí esta noche con Spaniard All-Star.
Thank you. Chaca, esa macocha.
Before I move forward into your time with Miles, I do want to mention Barry Rogers and your playing with him. Is that where you met him in the band, you know, being in the band?
No, I knew Barry as being the shining light in the Latin jazz scene way before Dreams. He was a very, very special trombone soloist with bands that go back to Mongo Santa Maria, many, many people like this.
Right.
Back in the late 60s. And the studio scene, he was always prominent there somehow. So then when we worked with Dreams, that was a lasting experience for maybe about a year or so. And then after that, I worked with Barry for Jerry Masucci and Fania Records.
Exactly.
Yeah, with our Latin thing, we did that whole situation at the Yankee Stadium. It's just very funny to watch, what always stood out for me was the idea that, okay, this is the last night at Yankee Stadium. It was a Friday night. All the way up to maybe 1 or 2 days before, I wasn't really sure whether we were going to do this or not. Because, as it was explained to me, no one could confirm in Jerry Masucci's office because they knew that if it rained, that probably no one would come. But if it was a nice night, everyone would come because it was Friday and they earned their paychecks on Friday. So sure enough, it didn't rain. We got there. Band's tickets, I think, were something like 2,000 tickets sold out of a possible 65,000 seats. And when we got there to get in, it was very, very tough because there was a line, actually illegal loitering, because there were so many people, and the police were not aware that this was going to happen, but that was the Latin community. So they came in droves, and there was, they didn't sell out the whole stadium, but yeah, you had about 30 or 40,000 people there. And the next thing you know, we're playing, and everything's going on really well, and it's just getting more and more and more intense and deeper into the night, say around 10 o'clock or so. They finally announced that Santana is going to play. But they never said which Santana. It turned out to be Jorge Santana, Carlos's brother. And people just went nuts. They didn't care. They just put Santana and myself. Jan Hammer was there. They stormed the stage.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. When they stormed the stage, the heroes of the whole thing were the Cungueros, which was, I think, Ray Barreto, Jocuba, Mongo Santa Maria, at least those three. Yeah. But they kept playing and well into the night. Well after we had left, I heard that they played for hours.
Wow.
To calm the people down. Otherwise, it would have been a lot of problems in the Bronx and on Grand Concourse. And what I remember walking out or trying to get out the back in with my technician and passing all of the rented equipment walking out with me above the heads of people who were leaving at the same time. It was a very interesting predicament.
Oh, goodness.
So whoever rented that stuff never got a chance to see it again, I think, unless they went to a pawn shop.
Okay.
It was very unique. We'll be right back.
Okay. I thought I'd interrupt very quickly just to let you know that if you didn't catch titles and things during the exchange, you can call me at 212-209-2900 in the studio right now. 212-209-2900. Or you can request a playlist by emailing me at sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. Sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. Stay tuned.
What I just told you, you couldn't, that's what it was.
Okay. It was like that all the time.
It was just very special. It's very unique.
Yeah.
And it had a certain kind of personality that you had to be, you had to be in tune to and ready to accept. There was no chance. You accepted it or you didn't accept it. You know, and for me it was, yeah, that's community. That's the way it is. Okay. No problem. As long as I know. Done.
So how did Miles wind up calling you?
Through Jack DeJohnette. I was working at the Village Gate performing with Junior Mance and Victor Venegas, I think, was the bass player, upstairs in the top of the gate. And downstairs was Miles with Chick Corea and Jack and Dave Holland and I think Wayne Shorter. And Jack had served notice and told Miles that after coming to speak to me, he told Miles that I would be interested to take his place. So Miles said, of course, wanted to hear what I was doing and came up, and I got a call a couple days later.
So did he have you come in and play a little, or what happened?
Well, he had me come in to, went to rehearse at his home, at his house, and it was at the rehearsal, if I'm not mistaken, was with John McLaughlin and bass player. I can't even remember. It might have been, I don't know, it could have been Dave Holland. Seemed like everybody was in their own world. And I was so petrified, I didn't know what to do.
What do you mean by being in their own world?
They were very much into the music, and they were trying to figure out just what to do with about the 10 or 12 notes that were on the page. That's all. They had some ideas as to direction and concept. And from what I remember, with Miles, it was about almost not speaking. It was almost like signals. You know, someone wrote something, if it worked, then he'd just go, okay, we'll use that. And whatever that was the beginning of what we do in the studio. When we got to the studio, all of that could be out the window and it would change. And then we'd do that.
This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM, Sugar in My Bowl. Honky Tonk is in the background, written by Miles Davis, recorded in, so it says, May 1970. Miles Davis on trumpet, Steve Grossman on soprano sax, John McLaughlin on guitar, Keith Jarrett on Fender Rhodes, an electric piano, Herbie Hancock on clavinet, Michael Henderson on electric bass, Billy Cobham on drums, and Ayerto Morera on percussion. Before that, what on earth did we hear? Oh my gosh, yes. We heard from the soundtrack, Salsa, the Fania All-Stars. This was Congo Bongo, which was recorded live in Yankee Stadium. 1976, this recording was released on the Fania label. Before that, we heard from the Fania All-Stars, Latin Soul Rock, How It Was, How It Ended, How It Was Going to Be. That's what it says on the release. And, yeah, that was Manu Dibango, Soul Makossa. I love that recording. I really do. Just hearing everybody and knowing that it was all happening in the Bronx. And, oh, gosh, the funny story. Well, yeah, so you can check this out if you miss something. You can check the program out in the archives for the next 14 days at archive.wbai.org. Just look for Sugar in My Bowl. It'll be there for 14 days. And let's see, did I miss anything? If I did, you can email me at sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. Or you can call me in the station at 212-209-2900, and I'll try to help you out. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and more Miles Davis and Billy Cobham. So this was for both B.B. and Jack Johnson?
Well, let's see, how many records? I know, the whole series, the Jack Johnson series, I think is encompassing On the Corner, Live Evil, Bitches Brew, Circling Around or Square, whatever they call it. All these things that I couldn't give you a clue, mm-hmm. except for Jack Johnson, where you could find me on those records.
Mm.
It's just, but I'm there somewhere, I just don't know where.
Is it because of the engineering and the mixing and the looping and the God knows what else?
Yeah, I guess so, you know.
Well, you know that you spent time with him, so.
Yeah, that's about it.
Do you think you got anything from having spent time with Miles?
Independent thinking, you know, learning to be responsible for my actions, and understanding that you have to be, if you make a mistake, you have to be responsible for the mistake, as well as the successes that you get. That's not always so easy. When you make a mistake, you normally want to run and hide.
No, that's true.
But I think that if you can learn from the mistake, you know, even if it's something that's quite embarrassing, then you've gained, you've not lost, because it's a mistake the first time. The second time, it's not a mistake. That's the difference.
So after you finished your time with Miles, I guess not, well, it seems like immediately afterwards, you stuck with McLaughlin after you ran into him with Miles and you became a founding member of Mahavishnu?
Yeah, but actually how that worked was that I was hired by John.
Oh.
I was not a partner, contrary to popular belief.
Okay.
That was John McLaughlin's project in total.
Okay.
And so therefore that's why you don't see any Billy Cobham material there. It wasn't something that we shared. It was just, I was quite understandable. I didn't write any music at that time, really. Maybe one or two things I was dabbling in, but no. And so when I recorded with John, it was all about his platform and what he wanted to do. That was enough for me to, there was so much to learn from that. It was good enough to just deal with that. That's fine.
Okay. Well, thanks for clarifying that.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you had your own stuff after that. You had your solo recordings. Was
Spectrum?
Spectrum, yes. Was that your first?
Okay. It was my first album, yes. And it was a recording that was made based on my observance that we did a lot. We worked over a year, two and a half years. I'd say that we were good for about 400 shows, 400 to 500 shows, in terms of performances, Mahavishnu. We were almost constantly, on the road. So I thought, hey, at some point in time, this band has to take a break, because I think we will have worn out our welcome in certain parts of the world.
Oh, my goodness.
So it would be natural for the band to stop for a while, 2-3 years, whatever, and do something else. You know, all other bands do that. Why not us? And, so I started to look at creating a niche for myself for when we were not together. And that's how Spectrum came about.
Are you familiar with Ursula Rucker, the spoken word artist?
Stratus has been, I mean, I've been successful with that with a band called Massive Attack.
Ah. What did you do with them?
They sampled Stratus and made a recording. It's called Safe from Harm. And it was done in the early 1990s, 1991, somewhere in there.
Oh, okay.
And it did very, 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 very good business for me.
New York.
That's probably the most played tune I've ever written.
Yeah. Folks like to sample you.
Apparently.
Tell me about the Billy Cobham George Duke Band.
How can I put this? It was another one of those spikes to kind of fill a gap. And we did our thing for about a year, and then it was done.
Oh, okay.
George was about to break out with his dookie stick and all that stuff. He was going the Chitlin Circuit. And I was just burnt out. I just wanted to stop.
All right, let's have a very great big hand for the George Duke Billy Cobham Band. Billy Cobham and George Duke Band.
So we worked together for a year with Alfonso Johnson and with John Scofield.
There's something that you, after all of these, I guess, arena concerts and what have you, you eventually started, and you'll have to tell me when you started doing this, started going back to for lack of a better phrase, African percussion?
World music?
Okay, if that works, yeah. And working with Acere?
Ah, wow. But now we're talking 1990s?
Yeah. How did you wind up going in that direction?
Well, I was associated with, for a while in the 1990s with a singer by the name of Peter Gabriel, and he exposed me. He had these projects that he sponsored, his organization, Real World, and the World of Music, Arts, and Dance, WOMAD. They had these world music festivals literally around the world. And so I got involved in that, and I met a lot of world-class musicians from places that I never dreamed I'd ever touch base with. China, Korea, all around the world, India, Africa, and Cuba, of course. And eventually, I was introduced to a group of musicians from Havana called Acere. And their main thing was to bring to the public their folkloric music, son, the way that they play in Cuba. And so we came together because many times I would go alone, just my drums, and I would put on a presentation for 1 hour, soloing and playing. And I was asked on one occasion if I wanted to collaborate with any of the other artists. And I said, okay, who do you have? And they told me about a Cuban band. And I said, sure, I'd love to work with them. Actually, the Cumbiero would be great. It would be fun to just work together and work call and response, which is like I play and then he reacts to what I play and I react to what he plays. And we have a conversation this way, and it's called call and response. And it worked out so well with this musician that I chose to push to try to spend some more time working together with him. And so I was lucky enough that they allowed me to do that.
Sentimiento de Cuba.
Do you have any plans of working together some more?
There's nothing at the moment, but it is a possibility that we will do some stuff down the road. Sure.
CTI, Cree Taylor.
Yes.
You did a lot of what you were sort of, you were the house drummer, weren't you?
It seemed like I was for a while. Yeah. I worked there with Ron Carter and George Benson. Mm-hmm. And the piano player from one day to another could have been Keith Jarrett or Richard Wyans or Herbie Hancock or Roland Hanna, Don Zabeski or Emir Diodato. It depended on whose project it was.
Okay, I should probably let you know what you're listening to right now. What you're listening to is Freddie Hubbard from Polar AC. This is Naturally. Of course, on Skydive, there's two other versions of Naturally on there. Anyway, this one has... goodness. I need a magnifying glass. But Billy Cobham is playing drums on this. Of course, Freddie Hubbard is on trumpet. It says here, Ron Carter's on bass, Jack DeJohnette. Well, that's not on this one, though. That's not on this cut. Oh, my goodness. You know, I give you all kinds of information that may or may not be right. But Billy Cobham's on here. And what was that we listened to before? De Cuba y de Panama from Billy Cobham and Acere, and that was released in 2008, and what we heard was the title cut. Before that we heard, oh boy, yeah, I'm going to, it would be so much better for you to email me at sugar, S-U-G-A in my bowl, at gmail.com. Sugar, S-U-G-A in my bowl, at gmail.com. Or you can call me at 212-209-2900. Ask me what you may have missed, and I'll let you know exactly what it is. Let's listen to more Naturally from Freddie Hubbard. And stay tuned. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in my bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. La Nueva Alternativa is coming up next, so we're getting ready to wrap this up really soon. Stay tuned. Thank you. Also recorded with Freddie Hubbard.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Skydive.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also Polar AC. Or at least that's what I in my notes, I see you on Polar AC. He does People Make the World Go Round on that one.
Yeah. You get all these things with different titles and all that, and you realize that we may have recorded that with, I don't know, Freddie Hubbard session, on a Milt Jackson session, and they decided not to use it. And then all of a sudden it comes out as a Freddie Hubbard tune. I mean, I don't know. Creed is a master at that kind of stuff.
I see. Do you remember any experience with Freddie Hubbard, playing with him?
Yeah, but it wasn't at CTI. We worked a lot together off and on, and there was always excitement when he was around. You never knew. If he was in the right mental state, he was untouchable musically, and he was such a giant. What really knocked me out was his articulation, the way he played consistently. It was an amazing gift. I was so sorry that it was overused, that he just lost his chops, and it was such a drag, because had he taken care of himself, he'd probably still be here today. But the times that we played together in the studio with Creed at Rudy Van Gelder's was amazing.
Fruit from the Loom. Talk to me about that project.
Okay. It's the first of a 4-record set that I'm working on. It's dedicated to my parents who went into transition back in 2006, 2007.
Thank you.
I decided to bring back some pieces that my mom and dad liked and spruce them up to represent how I am now, arrangement-wise, and to add to them new composition. At first, it was going to be called the Fruit from the Loom Project, but something that you could relate to is the same as Music of My Mind from Stevie Wonder. As I continued to write, I found that it really didn't stick. Next one after that was Palindrome. That's got a story all of itself. The project that we're working on now is called Tales from the Skeleton Coast, and that's a whole South African thing, so it just goes on like this. So these are three or four records that will be coming out very soon. It has a lot to do with band concept, small band, middle-sized band, large orchestral ensemble, and eventually it'll be four CDs. But Fruit from the Loom is number one. It takes Crosswinds, Spectrum. Those are the recordings from my first and second album, the title tunes. And then on there is Cat in the Hat and things like this.
Education. What is your method of teaching? How do you decide what you're going to teach?
Most often than not, if I'm given a mandate to present a presentation, let's say we simply have a drum set in a room, I will sit down with one student amongst a group of students, and we will deal with performance concepts based on my approach to playing. And I will make this presentation musically and verbally. And I will then try to go through it, physically go through it with the student as an example. Anyone who wants to come up and play it, can. And we will critique what they do. The students in the class will also have a chance to make comments and critique as well. So it's not just about talking. It's about doing.
Is that pretty much how you learned?
Yes. Being observant, watching, asking questions, making mistakes, but understanding why they were mistakes. What worked and what didn't, and why.
A friend of mine had wanted me to ask you about, it was one of your recordings, something Libra.
Early Libra.
Yeah, she wanted me to ask you about that. I guess she wanted to know what was your, what inspired you to come up with Early Libra.
A Libra?
Doesn't a Libra inspire you?
Yeah. It was something, I don't know what happened, but this person made a major impression in my life at that time, and I've always had a tendency to then, when impressions are made upon me, I then write something that reflects that. And that's what came up.
Okay.
There's a project I'm doing called Tales from the Skeleton Coast. And I have four daughters. And of the four daughters, one is, the second oldest is a diplomat and worked in the Peace Corps back in the 90s. And so I went to visit her in southwestern Africa, which is Namibia. And in the Kalahari Desert, we started to go towards the Angolan border and the coast. And north of Swakopmund are these moving sand dunes. And they can become very, very high, 200 meters high, which is about 600 feet of sand that moves all through the desert from day to day. And they cover the roads. Down on the coast, it's called the Skeleton Coast, which is, you'll find all these old ships. This is one of the regions of the world where the land is reclaiming itself from the Atlantic Ocean there. So ships will get caught on land very easily if they're a little bit too close to shore. And the sand dunes will get onto them and move them in. So it made an impression on me, and I started to write about this over time. And now I have a lot of material that I'm leaning in that direction. The title tune is called Tales from the Skeleton Coast, and it's a pretty big piece. It just without any solos alone, it's about 15 minutes long. It's a very extended work.
Wow.
You know, and it's mostly, again, it's working with not a large orchestra, but everyone in the band has something to do, and it's written mostly, and then solos come much later.
I'm sorry, what comes much later?
Solos.
Oh, okay. Is there anything you want to share with the WBAI audience before we disconnect?
It's just nice to know that jazz is still happening on the East Coast, the way you have a radio station. I just didn't think it existed anymore. I haven't been in the United States since 1981. Living consistently and understanding what's going on with the local society on a day-to-day basis, I thought it was just still that whole smooth jazz thing.
It's just painful.
The gold, what they call that stuff? The quiet storm and all that kind of stuff. And I just assumed that, that was still going on. So I just BAI. That's cool.
Thank goodness there is a BAI.
I have a story for you. Okay, one thing I remembered, I'm pretty sure this happened, it was with BAI. I was in the studio with Miles at 30th Street, and we were preparing to record something. Miles had an electrical device that he was putting on his trumpet for the very first time, and it had a speaker and all of this. At 30th Street was an old church that Columbia owns or used for recording large ensembles like the Philharmonic Orchestra and all of this. And we had time there for some reason to do something. And while he was setting up, it was, late afternoon, say around 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon for the session. He started getting a sound check, and all of a sudden he heard a very special, somebody was playing. He didn't understand that the wire that was going from his trumpet microphone, that was on the bell of his microphone, was not shielded. And so it became an antenna, and the antenna was receiving a signal from WBAI coming through his speaker, okay? So we were trying to, he was just trying to get a level, and all of a sudden, he said, "What is that? I know that tune." And it turned out to be one of the tunes from, it was from Quiet Nights, yeah.
Hmm.
And Gil Evans was in the room, and he said, "Dewey, that's from Quiet Nights." And it was actually Miles playing, and he started to play with that record.
With WBAI.
Yeah, it was on BAI, and then I remembered because somebody came on and said, "You listen to WBAI." And we were all playing. I don't know if they recorded it or not, but it was a special moment.
Excellent. Well, we have special moments here at WBAI. You being on with Sugar in My Bowl is definitely one of those moments.
Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you, Billy Cobham, for joining us.
Great.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.